I hope y'all appreciate the hours I spent painting this picture of Jonah. And I will tell you this, if you can, in the very far distance, you might see what appears to be the tail of a whale sticking up. You know, I'm not responsible for what Google Images decides on something like that. But when we come to Jonah, and this is, to me, kind of after, you know, spending four class periods talking about how you approach the prophets, how you study the prophets, I then start this one off by saying, okay, for today and for Wednesday night, you can forget all of that, because Jonah is not like the other prophets. It's just not a book like them. You know, of course, it's the one minor prophet that people are the most familiar with. You know, everybody, you know, children have heard, children have heard the story of Jonah, you know, and the world, you know, they know at least something about Jonah. But I think that the real message of this book is not always understood and appreciated, and I didn't for a long time, and I'm still learning things about it. But when we come to Jonah, one thing that is different about this book is, for the first time in our study so far, we can say with, you know, certainty, we know about the time he lived. Now, that's not to say, you know, we can pinpoint the year of his prophecy. But when we talked about Obadiah, while I think the bulk of the evidence points to around 585, 586 B.C., there are some good arguments to be made for an earlier date. And there are even a couple other dates that have some credence. With Joel, you know, probably after the Babylonian captivity. But where in there? I don't have any idea. But when we come to Jonah, chapter 1, verse 1 says, "The word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying..." Now, Jonah, the son of Amittai. Turn to 2 Kings 14. And I think the words that are used here are interesting. Now, Jeroboam is going to be the king. Oftentimes we call him, as up here it says, Jeroboam the second. This is not a Jeroboam who is Jeroboam Jr. You know, Jeroboam was the first king of divided Israel. You know, when Solomon died and the kingdom divided, Jeroboam became king over Israel. This one's not even, you know, a direct descendant, but he has the same name. He reigned from somewhere about 790 to 749 B.C. You know, the first half of that 8th century B.C., and he was not a good man. You know, verse 24, he did the same things as Jeroboam the son of Nebat, Jeroboam the first, the one that made the golden calves. But look at what it says. Verse 25, he restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord God of Israel, which he had spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. For the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, and whether bond or free, there was no helper for Israel. And the Lord did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now, Jeroboam, though he was not a good king in the spiritual sense, God used him to restore Israel. And when you look at the brown shaded area, there were some times, notice up here the Syria. You read the history of the kings, there were some times when they cut off much of Israel's territory. They were great oppressors. But under Jeroboam in the north, and Uzziah in the south, in Judah, and Uzziah was a good king. Now, Israel and Judah both have expanded. And it says that Jonah, the servant of Amittai, and notice what he's called, the Lord's servant. Israel as a whole was not faithful to the Lord. But Jonah is called the servant of the Lord. He spoke of this. So there he is in the time of Jeroboam, speaking of restoration. And so we've got that. But the word of the Lord came to him and said, going back to Jonah now, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. And you know what's going to happen. Jonah's told to head off kind of in a northeasterly direction, and he's going to come down. Oh, wrong button. He's going to head west. And I want to take just a moment to look at a map of the Assyrian Empire. And I will tell you, this map is about 70 or so years after Jonah, when it shows Israel has already been taken into captivity. But I want us to be able to see that Nineveh is up here. And the Assyrian Empire, 790, 780 BC, whenever Jonah might have been prophesying, was definitely by far the most powerful nation in that part of the world. And we can read from historical sources, they had already at times threatened Israel. But historians also tell us at this point, they were facing some great enemies off to the east, around the Caspian Sea. They were torn by some internal strife. In the period from about 800 to 745, was one of Assyria's weaker times. Now, I won't say weak. They were still a strong nation, a nation to be feared. But they weren't as strong. They weren't moving. They just weren't capable of the westward expansion at this point. And so that helps maybe to set a background. Why are Israel and Judah both prospering, growing during this time? Why is Nineveh going to be responsive to Jonah? Maybe that helps us to understand that. But the story, as we're going to see it, is Jonah, instead of going to Nineveh, he goes to Joppa. Joppa was Israel's only seaport, and it wasn't a really great one. By the first century, do you remember what seaport Cornelius resided at? Caesarea? And that was, Herod the Great had constructed an artificial harbor to make for a better one. But Israel wasn't a sea-growing people. But let's look at the story of Jonah. You know what's going to happen. He's going to be swallowed by this great fish, be in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. And, a lot of people think that's just a myth. Some, that's people who don't take the Bible seriously. There are those who would say that, it's a fable. It's kind of like the tortoise and the hare. Nobody thinks the tortoise and the hare really had a race, but the story is told to teach us the importance of perseverance, and that's kind of what the story of Jonah is, or it's a parable, or, some just treat it as pure fiction. Well, if you take seriously the words of Jesus, and I do, this is a historical reality. Jesus in Matthew, the 12th chapter, and I'll read it. I won't read Luke 11, but he says something similar. But Matthew, the 12th chapter, Jesus will say, You know, this evil generation seeks after a sign, verse 39. No sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here. If you decide that the story of Jonah is just, you know, a big whopping fish tale that can't be true, then I don't know how you can accept the story of Jesus and his resurrection. You know, he says that it's going to be like that. And, you know, Jonah is a reality and a very flawed character. I don't know. And it raises a question. Did Jonah write this book that bears his name, or did God have some other prophet record it? Because at the end of the book, we will notice this Wednesday night, there's no statement of repentance on the part of Jonah. You know, and so, you know, I don't know what the situation was. It may have been written by, you know, another prophet recording the book. You know, who knows? But we're going to see a guy who was not a really great character. But what he does, look at Acts 11, verse 18. Then we're going to dig into the book real quick, get into it. But Acts 11 and verse 18, when Peter's gone to the house of Cornelius, it says after he's recounting the story in Jerusalem, when they heard these things, they became silent and they glorified God, saying, then God has also granted to the Gentiles repentance to life. In a very real sense, I think Jonah is a foreshadowing of the New Testament. We're going to see Nineveh, a Gentile city, with repentance unto life. And, you know, that was God's aim throughout the Old Testament, that one day that would happen. Well, watch for these four lessons. Jonah tries to run from God. You cannot do that. The Lord is not the God of Israel exclusively. He is the God of all the nations. The Lord has many weapons at his disposal. In this book, you will see the Lord use a storm. You'll see him use a fish. You will see him use the sun and the wind. You'll see him use some kind of plant. You'll see him use a worm. You know, he will use many elements of nature to accomplish his purposes. And I don't doubt that he cannot do that today. And one of the great lessons of Jonah is the one that Jonah didn't know. Love your neighbor as yourself. That was the second great commandment. Well, let's get into this book and let's just look at it. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the son of Amittai, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it. Just in case I forget to say this Wednesday night, the second time the Lord appears to Jonah, and I don't know what the significance of this is, but he will say in the third chapter, verse 2, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it. Instead of against it, he'll just say to it the second time. I don't know if there's a purpose in that. But he said, their wickedness has come up before me. Nineveh, the Assyrians were known for their cruelty. They reveled in cruelty. They didn't seek to just defeat a nation. They sought to demoralize a nation. you know, their commanders would take the skins of defeated soldiers. I mean, they would skin them like you would an animal, you know, and use that to make decorations and things. And there have been found carvings, you know, where they inscribe, where it shows them pulling the tongues of people out and torture and just making cuts, all of tying someone down and cutting them across the back numerous times. They were a wicked, wicked people. Well, God, understandably, cried against their wickedness. But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And you look at this. 2 Kings calls him the servant of the Lord. And the servant of the Lord, who evidently prophesied faithfully in Israel regarding Jeroboam, these things, what does he up and do? He decides he's going to flee from what? Flee from God. How do you get away from where can you go to flee from the presence of the Lord? Remember David answering that in Psalm 139? You know, David saying, I go, you know, top of the mountain, I can go to the bottom of the sea. You know, there's nowhere I escape your presence. And I don't know. Some have thought that he meant that he knew that he wouldn't actually be away from the Lord, but he was only a prophet as long as he was in Israel. No, I think we're trying to ascribe rational thought to a pretty irrational behavior. Sometimes people just do stupid things, you know, and we try to come up with some good explanation for it. Jonah does something foolish. And there's a very interesting little note, and you probably have heard this before, but notice the word down. He's from Galilee. Gath-Hepher was not far from what would later be Nazareth. Nazareth was not an Old Testament village, but he's from that general area. He went down to Joppa. He gets a ship going to Tarshish, which is thought to be southwestern Spain, you know, which would have been the end of the world to a Jew. You pass that, you're out in the Atlantic, nobody wants to go out there, you know. I mean, that's the end of the world. He goes down into the ship. Verse 5, he had gone down into the lowest parts of the sea, you know. And then what's going to happen? He's going to go down into the water. I don't know, but it almost seems as if the writer's trying to make a point. When you start running away from God, there's only one direction you can go, and that's down. You know, you're not going up when you are fleeing from the Lord. So, hey, great plan. But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship was about to be broken up, and the mariners are afraid, and where's Jonah? What's he doing during this storm? He's sleeping. Now, let me make a point. The English Standard Version that I know some of you use, in verse 4, it said the Lord hurled out a great wind. And that's interesting because it's the same word that's used in verse 15 when they threw him into the sea. And the English Standard has hurled in both places. And I feel pretty good about saying that doesn't seem to be coincidental. That whether it be Jonah or a later prophet who recorded the story of Jonah, that God hurled a storm, and the only way it stopped is when they hurled him into the sea. He uses the same word to bookend this. But you start thinking about Jonah and Jesus. We remember Jesus being asleep during a storm. And he had to be awakened, right? That's what's going to happen here. The sailors, the mariners, they're doing all they can. They're praying to their gods. And Jonah's asleep. And they wake him up. Now, key difference. Jonah's the reason for this storm. But then you will see who calmed the storm on the Sea of Galilee in the time of Jesus? Jesus did. Who calms this storm? Well, in a very real sense, Jonah does. But not in the way that Jesus did. And then you think about Jonah was willingly offered himself to die for the people on that ship. That's one of the few moments of nobility the man seems to have. And then look at the sailors. When he offers to die for them, what do they try to do? They try to row hard to get to shore. And when they finally realize they had no choice but to hurl him into the sea, they ask that they not be charged with his innocent blood. When Jesus is offered, what did they say? His blood be upon us and on our children. I think it's just amazing how many similarities and contrast that are here in this story. And I believe that this event that took place almost 800 years before Jesus, it was controlled by one who knew what was going to happen 800 years later and knew there would be these similarities and these contrasts. But, you know, they wake up Jonah and they told him, you know, you pray to your God. And then they cast the lots. And some means of, you know, drawing straws, cutting cards, yes?
One more similarity that came just...
Okay.
Same words, but essentially he was sleeping. Yeah. Like, I'm just hanging out, why are you bothering me? And they said, why aren't you panicking?
Yeah.
They said the same thing to Jesus.
Yep, that is another one. You know, that, you know, don't, Master, don't you care that we're perishing? In this case, what do you mean, sleeper, get up? You know, here we are, we're all worried. You should be too. Well, then they asked Jonah, you can just imagine these questions when the lot fell on. Tell us, verse 8. For whose cause is this trouble upon us? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What's your country? Of what people are you? And he said, I am a Hebrew and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land. And I will say, there's something good in that. Baal was sometimes thought to be the storm god. Jonah makes it clear, no. I serve the Lord, Yahweh. He's the God. Now, if he is the God who made the sea and the dry land, why in the world did I think I could flee from his presence? But he told them in verse 10 what he had done. And they were afraid. So he said, what can we do? And he said, I think you're going to have to throw me into the water. Now, that does raise a question. If Jonah was convinced that he was the problem and his going overboard would take care of it, there's an alternative to making them throw him in, isn't there? You know, he could have just dove right in. But he, and I don't know, maybe he thinks it almost has to be like a sacrifice. But he tells them, you've got to put me in the water. And they rowed hard. You know, and they couldn't, the sea is more tempestuous. And so they, and notice in verse 14, they are this time, in verse 5, they cried out each to his own God. This time they're crying out to the Lord. And they ask that he not hold them, you know, with innocent blood. You know, we're not murderers. We're only doing what it's obvious you expect us to do. So they hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. And then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, offered a sacrifice to the Lord, and took vows. Note what they did. They offered sacrifice, took vows. Look at the end of Jonah 2 and verse 9. You know, the end of Jonah in the belly of the fish. What I was going to say. I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay what I have vowed. Again, I don't think that's intended to be coincidental. What happens with all of this? It causes these Gentile, pagan sailors to offer sacrifice to the Lord, to give, you know, their praise unto him. It causes his prophet to come back to him. In the first chapter, he's running from the Lord. He's about to run to the Lord. Well, the Lord had prepared a great fish. And the word prepared is not the word for created. You know, it could simply mean he had it there in the right place at the right time. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. I want to give you a thought. I've seen this expressed recently. Never heard anybody say it until the last few years. That Jonah actually died inside the great fish and then came back to life. Or else the parallel to Jesus wouldn't be complete. Well, Jesus didn't get put in the belly of a fish. You know, he was in a tomb. You know, to me, it seems pretty clear that the second chapter is the prayer of a man who was as good as dead. You know, that he expected to die. And he didn't. I don't see that one. One other one, and I will grant this one as a possibility, but it's also, don't assume things that are not stated. Inside the stomach of any animal, you would have a rather acidic place to be, right? And I've read these things that when Jonah came out from that fish, that his skin was forever blotched by the acid burns and the stuff. And possibly, but if he's fully immersed in that acid, he would have been blind. His lungs would have been scarred forever. You know, I don't know. You know, and people said, that's the sign, you know, to the people of Nineveh. It never says that. You know, don't make more of it. God preserved this man in the fish's belly. And when you look at verse 1, he prayed to the Lord from the fish's belly. And he said, now, when I read this prayer, it looks to me almost as if more of a reflection of praise and thanksgiving than the account of the prayer itself. That this is looking back and my prayer was answered. You know, look at what he says. I cried out to the Lord because of my affliction, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas. All the floods surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. Then I said, I have been cast out of your sight. Yet I will look again toward your holy temple. The waters surrounded me, even to my soul. The deep closed around me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I went down to the moorings of the mountains. The earth with its bars closed behind me forever. Yet you have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer went up to you into your holy temple. Those who regard worthless idols forsake their own mercy, but I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay what I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord. This strikes me as the reflection. It's a psalm, basically, of a man who said, I was swallowed up. You know, I went down into the deep. I was about to drown. And then you think, out of the frying pan into the fire, as this big fish swallows him. And he knows that any second now he'll be dead. And maybe he began to pray immediately. Or maybe a moment or two goes by and he realizes, you know, I'm not dead. You know, maybe there's a reason God has given me this. And he begins to pray. And he's looking back now. And he says, you know, I was at my lowest point, verse 7, and I remembered the Lord. My prayer went up to your holy temple, and I'm going to offer my sacrifice. I'm going to pay my vows. Did he? You know, we're never told. You know, I don't know, you know, about any of that, but it's a beautiful, poetic, it's as much as chapter 1 is so ugly in him running from God, here is a man desperately running toward God, seeking his help, finding in him salvation. And so the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Now, where was Jonah when he was vomited? Did the fish swim back to Canaan, Palestine, you know, spit him out close to Joppa? Did it spit him out on, you know, somewhere along the coast of what we'd call Turkey, North Africa? I don't know. You know, you wonder, how long did it take him to get back home? Did he get back home? You know, how long did it take him to try to find some place he could wash that vomit off? You know, there are a lot of great questions in this chapter. But the key in this chapter to me is simply this. This is a man that was given a very easy to understand charge. He knew what he was supposed to do. He didn't do it. God came after him. And he realized his folly. And the next time God says go, we're going to look Wednesday night, he will go. But what we're going to find out is it would seem, well, let me back this up. The two great commandments of the law were you were to do what first? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second one was what? Love your neighbor. It would appear that Jonah gets the message that you love God, or at least you obey God. But we're going to see very clearly Wednesday night. He didn't get the part about loving your neighbor. And, you know, I can remember, and I don't know that a teacher ever told me this. I probably just made it up in my mind. That Jonah didn't go to Nineveh the first time. He didn't want to go there. He was scared of those people. They, as I said, they were legendary for their cruelty. They were enemies of Israel. And so, I had this idea growing up. Somehow I got it that, he was afraid of those people. You know, if they went there, he's a Hebrew, and he's telling them to change their lives, they're liable to kill him. That wasn't why he didn't want to go at all. He didn't care about those people. And God's going to try to teach him how to care. And, that's going to be our Wednesday night lesson. In many ways, you'd think a lot more of Jonah if the book ended right here. But God goes on to tell us, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. And it gets ugly. Okay, any thoughts, questions, comments? Before, we've got a few minutes here, I think. Yes?
Yeah, it sounds like you're alluding to this, but having the same thought, it's difficult to marry the idea of Jonah's prayer in chapter 2 and this idea of him consciously choosing to run away from God. It doesn't seem to match kind of like our human nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was just straight up prejudiced.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to help them.
Yeah.
He knew who he served. And he knew that if they repented, that God would spare them.
Yeah.
And of course, we see that in later chapters, that he's mad about it when he does that.
Yeah.
And so, kind of marrying those two ideas with this guy who's just praying this beautiful repentant, thankfulness prayer to God for saving him, it seems like he's viewing being swallowed by this fish as his salvation.
Yeah.
Right. And then later on, this difference between this just intense hatred.
Yeah.
But still having this love and appreciation of this relationship with God, and how those two are just diametrically opposed to one another. It's
yeah.
It's really great.
We need to be careful that we don't fail to see those dangers in our own lives. Let me give y'all something to watch for as you prepare for Wednesday night. Chapter 4, verse 2. The words that he uses there, and I think I pointed this out in Joel, but Joel uses almost the exact same words in a very good way. Jonah uses them in an angry way. And they're a reflection of Exodus 34. Go back to Exodus 34. Read that. And then begin to notice in your Old Testament readings how often that self-description that God uses of himself with Moses, how often it will be quoted, alluded to, somehow referenced throughout it. But Wednesday night, we will look at chapters 3 and 4, and we'll see chapter 3, the good Jonah, chapter 4, the bad Jonah, kind of the opposite. The first chapter, mostly the bad Jonah, though giving him his life. Anyway, all right, we'll be dismissed.